Our latest Star Trek Rewatch podcast is sponsored by TrueCar. When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. Paying too much would be a disaster, not unlike the quantum filament that the Enterprise D runs into in this episode we're about to talk about. Now, unfortunately, a lot of times you're not getting that actual pricing. People configure a car online only to find out that later on they're not available. But with TrueCar, you can get the real pricing on the actual inventory. Not just pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from the actual dealer. And not just any old dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. A carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. What TrueCar does is that they're going to tell you exactly what other people in your area paid for the same car that you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by that TrueCar certified dealer network. And there's over 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. You can work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer contact, and TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process, maybe even at warp speed, when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. And TrueCar users also save an average of $3,000 off of MSRP. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states. Star Trek The Next Generation is over, but we are just getting started talking about disaster from season 5. And now, here are the two guys who are ready to complete the Starfleet birthing simulation of this podcast. I am Rob Cesarino, and here is John Krause. John, how are you?
I'm doing great, Rob. Thanks for having me. I just want to announce that I've recently gotten my Starfleet merit badge in radishes. So
yes,
I'm good to go.
Good. You will be our radish officer on this podcast. And if you missed my first Star Trek podcast here on Post Show Recaps, I spoke with TV writer David Wright about his favorite episode, The City on the Edge of Forever, which was a very fun time. I had, at least. Hope you enjoyed it too. And so we are continuing our mission of talking to various different friends of post-show recaps and RHAP about some of their favorite Star Trek episodes. And so John and I had been chatting for a while about doing something Star Trek related. And I said, okay, John, give me your favorite Star Trek episode, and he came back and said, give me a few options, but said, thought it would be most fun to talk about Disaster from season 5 of TNG.
Yeah, I really, really like this episode. It's probably not on most people's like top 10 lists for Star Trek or even for TNG, but I think it does a lot of things really well. I think that it's really well written. I think that it reveals a lot about the characters, and I also think that it takes place in a very important part of TV history where we can see a lot of future television kind of stemming from this idea. And at the same time, it also does a lot of great homages to like classic disaster movies. And it's just a lot of fun. I think it really encapsulates the fifth season era of Star Trek really well.
Okay, well, I'm very excited to get into all of this. As I mentioned in the previous podcast we did, TNG is really my jam. I love all things Next Generation, and probably, if not multiple times, at least I've gone through every single episode, and certainly at one point, you know, knew this all backwards and forwards. For me, while I'm doing a lot of Star Trek Discovery stories, for me, it's a bit of Star Trek rediscovery. So it's a lot of stuff that I have not looked at in a really long time, but I'm excited to look back in sort of a nostalgic way about all of this. We got a new iTunes feed created for this podcast also since our last episode. You could subscribe to get all of these Star Trek episodes at postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. And of course, we will begin our weekly recaps of Star Trek Discovery coming up when that show premieres later on this month. So be on the lookout for that John, I'd love to, just before we get into talking about Disaster, what is your backstory with Star Trek?
I would say that my earliest Star Trek memory is that I was raised watching Star Wars, and then I kind of got through those movies. I'm old enough that there was only three at the time that I watched Star Wars, and I was kind of craving anything space-related, and I remember one day I was probably like 7 years old, and an episode of the original series was on TV, and my dad was like, oh, watch this. You'll like that. It's similar. And to like 7 year old me, I was like, this is not similar. There's no lightsabers. You know, there's no force. I was not into it. And I actually was like, this kind of sucks. And then I, you know, when I got into my teenage years, I was like, oh, you know, Star Trek versus Star Wars. Like, I'll take Star Wars anytime. But then 2009 rolled around and the J.J. Abrams 2009 Star Trek movie came out. And I saw the trailers for it, and I was like, this is interesting, because I've been a big fan of J.J. Abrams for a long time. I was super into Lost when it came out. I really liked Fringe. And I also am a huge Simon Pegg fan. Like, I've loved Simon Pegg for forever. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I'll give this a try. It seems like a good sort of jumping in point. It's like a big Hollywood movie. And I loved it. Like, I really, really, really liked that movie. I saw it, I think, two or three times in the theaters, and then I was like, okay, let me give this another chance. And so that's 2009. So I was about 19. And at that point, I think that my brain was developed enough that I watched the original series, which was on CBS.com at the time. It wasn't on Netflix or anything yet. And I really liked it. I was like, wow, this is so much more, like, I liked it so much more than Star Wars at that point in my life, because there was all this talk about sort of like equal, you know, who has rights and who doesn't have rights and what's the right thing to do and who has sentience and who doesn't. And it really kind of tapped my like early college mind. And so I watched all of that. And then in grad school, in between writing lots and lots of psychology papers, I worked my way through all of the other series. So I have seen them all at this point, and I really love them. And I think that now, if you said Star Trek or Star Wars, I would definitely side on the side of Star Trek. But luckily, we live in a world where we can have both.
Do you have a favorite franchise of all of the various Star Trek incarnations at this point?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that TNG is definitely my favorite. If I had to say which one is the best, I would probably go with Deep Space Nine. I think that that is probably the tightest written series, and it has a lot of the, like, just from an academic perspective, like the quote unquote best episodes. But TNG is just so watchable. The Next Generation, you can just pick it up at any point, you can watch it. And I just feel so much more like attached to those characters.
Let's discuss Disaster. Of course, this is from the fifth season. The original air date is October 21st, 1991, the day after my birthday. So I would have been celebrating my 13th birthday watching this episode. And wow. I'm sure that I was watching this episode in real time at this point. I actually did not watch the series on a weekly basis up until, I think, probably around late season four, right around this time going through it. So I think that this was right around the time that I was on board every single week.
That's great. You know, I was just about to turn two, yes. So I wasn't watching it.
Not yet. You were the next generation of Star Trek fans to come along.
Exactly.
So give us the backstory of why this episode in particular. I know you said that the writing is good, but what made you really get attached to this episode the first time through?
Well, I think it's a really great intro episode to introduce someone to Star Trek. It doesn't get too dry. There's a lot of action, but there is a lot of these really, really great character moments. And I also really like how it splits the crew up in really interesting ways. And it puts just about everyone in the crew into a situation that they're super uncomfortable in, and that isn't normal for that character to be in. And I think that you actually can learn a lot about the characters and who they are as people and as characters by how they react to these awkward situations. So it's not something you need a ton of backstory. You don't have to explain, like, oh, this is so-and-so. This is Dr. Crusher. This is so-and-so. Like, you get it all in the episode. And so I think if you're trying to introduce Star Trek to somebody, you can just kind of give them this episode, and they'll have a lot of fun with it. But they'll walk away knowing just about everybody's character and everybody's relationship with every other character. And it's just a lot of fun. Like, it's a disaster movie in space.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never really thought about it like that, but it really does work on that level where if you take a look at all of the different subplots in the story, everybody is doing something sort of left-handed that they're not used to doing. So they're put in all these different situations. If you haven't seen this episode or need a refresher, this is an episode in which the Enterprise runs into something called a quantum filament, which for all intents and purposes is sort of like a pothole in space where they end up just for, you know, that through no reason, something just happens really out of the blue that who even knew, John, that these things could just pop up like this and just completely disable the ship, that you would think that Starfleet would like commission like a committee to study where these quantum filaments are at this point, right?
Well, it's funny because as far as I know, this never comes up before
or ever
again. So it's one of those things that it's like there's just lots of dangers floating around in space. And Chief O'Brien definitely seems to know what it is, but it's not something that seems to be a serious problem. And yet it almost blows up the ship.
Yeah.
There's a funny point halfway through the episode where he's trying to explain to Deanna Troi sort of what it is. What is this quantum filament? And he's also kind of explaining it to the audience. And she's like, oh, is it kind of like a big string, like a cosmic string?
Yeah, cosmic string.
And he's like, no, it's nothing like that.
No, idiot, it's not.
Which is apparently a reference to a previous episode. I think that in season 4, they come across a cosmic string and have a different sort of disaster. So there's a lot of just like thin, dangerous things floating out in space.
Who knew? And so the Enterprise runs into this. It completely disables the ship, and the Enterprise actually takes a lot of casualties. We don't really spend a lot of time mourning for the dead here in this episode, but it seems as though that a lot of people got hurt and injured in this incident, and then a number of the different crew members are stranded in various situations. Picard in a turbo lift with a bunch of kids that won a science project. Deanna Troi is the ranking officer on the bridge with Chief O'Brien and Ensign Roe. Riker and Data, they start off in 10 forward, but then they end up going through one of the crawl space Jeffrey tubes on their way to engineering. Worf ends up having to deliver Keiko O'Brien's baby. We see Geordi LaForge and Dr. Crusher sort of stranded in the shuttle bay with radioactive material. Everything has gone to hell in a handbasket in this episode, John.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how everyone ends up in a different place. In my notes here, I just have Riker and Data go on a crawling adventure.
Yes.
but yeah, and another thing I think that this is a really good episode for is that it balances 5 plot lines. Most, you know, TV writing 101, you have plot line A and plot line B. I think this one bites off a lot. It has 5 different plot lines, but I think it balances them all pretty well. And it also introduces or reintroduces a lot of these side characters. By the time you get to season 5 of The Next Generation, you have a whole bunch of like these background crew members that show up from time to time. You have Keiko and Chief O'Brien and Ensign Roe, and they all get to sort of be their own stars in this episode. And I think it's interesting that in 1991, we have a show that has already like 12 main characters, which is unheard of in the 90s. And then now you're starting to throw in even more people. I think it's sort of an early sign of where TV is starting to go with like, it's almost Game of Thrones-esque. Like you have like 20 characters all doing different things. You're cutting back and forth between 5 different places. And it's another reason why I think this is a really good episode is how well it balances all of that.
Well, Ensign Roe was newly added to the cast at this point. She, I believe, makes her first appearance a few episodes earlier. Chief O'Brien, if this was the WWE, they're sort of like giving him a big push because he is going to soon be leaving for Deep Space Nine. And I think they knew that at this point, that he was going to end up being one of the characters on Deep Space Nine. So they wanted to try to build him up a little bit. And also from some of the show notes I was reading online, that I think that they believed that Ensign Roe was also going to go and be on Deep Space Nine as well. But then Michelle Forbes didn't want to go on Deep Space Nine. And that's where ultimately the Kira character came from, after Ensign Roe didn't want to go beyond Deep Space Nine. So that they were sort of trying to build up this struggle between these two characters as sort of something that was going to be built into Deep Space Nine.
Right, yeah, and you can definitely see it if you are familiar with Deep Space Nine, the character of Kira. They're both the same alien species, they're Bajorans, and they both kind of have, like, at the beginning of the series anyway, sort of this crotchety demeanor. It's interesting that Michelle Forbes turned it down. I guess she had better plans.
Yeah, because she's not really going to be a mainstay in the Next Generation. She's going to sort of like end up, she'll show back up, I think, in season 7. But for whatever reason, she seemed to, I don't know her backstory with the show. It seems like maybe she did not love her time on Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm a big Michelle Forbes fan. She's like one of these character actors that shows
up. She's had an interesting career. She's in
all
everything.
Over the place. She was on True Blood for a while. Like, she's, if you are a fan of genre television, like, you know who Michelle Forbes is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess she, too nerdy. Star Trek, too much. Vampires, yes. Star Trek, no.
Yeah. Well, maybe at that point in her career that she had a million different options, and then she sort of ended up being in a lot of genre TV after the fact. I don't want to talk too much about her career because I don't know everything that's right. going on there. Looks like she also did Battlestar Galactica along the way. She also was in The Killing.
Yeah, and speaking of Battlestar Galactica, another great part of TV history with this episode is that this episode was written by Ronald D. Moore, who is a very prolific Star Trek writer. He wrote for just about every Star Trek series, and then he was the showrunner on Battlestar Galactica, and he also ran Roswell, which was another kind of interesting sci-fi show in the early 2000s. I think he currently is on Outlander, which I don't watch, but I know that there are a lot of people who really love that show. So he's sort of like a genre television mainstay, and he cut his teeth on TNG and on this episode.
I should also add Michelle Forbes, of course. She was part of, I think that was the 5th season of Lost. She's been on Orphan Black, so a lot of genre shows for her. But let's get through talking about this episode, which begins with O'Brien and Keiko, the it couple of TNG at this point. They're talking about baby names for the unborn baby. They do not seem to know the sex of the baby, which who knew in the 24th century, with medical technology advancing to such a degree, that O'Brien and Keiko would want to not even know the sex of this unborn baby.
Right. I always kind of pictured that once you get into the 24th century, that it's one of those things that some couples, maybe they just don't want to know. Like, you can determine gender now, or you can determine sex now of a baby, but there are still people who choose not to know. They want it to be a surprise. So, you know, maybe Keiko and O'Brien, that's just sort of like they're looking forward to the surprise of it all.
So they're looking forward to talking about these baby names. Of course, Riker has to throw out, why don't you name the baby William?
Yeah, typical Riker. I mean, he probably thinks it's his baby. Let's be honest. Like, he's...
What? That I don't believe that there was any sort of cuckolding type relationship here between Riker and Chief O'Brien. I know he outranks him, but
no, but
that
I just think that William Riker thinks that he's a ladies' man, and I have a feeling that he gets around on the Enterprise. There's like 900 people on that ship.
Yeah, Riker, he is sort of known as a womanizer in the show, but not a lot is made of him dating any of the women that are sort of the junior officers. Like, he never has a serious relationship.
Him and Deanna at one point kind of have like an on again, off again thing.
Sure, sure. Certainly a lot of that from before the series begins. But you wonder, you know, what the sexual harassment policy might be in terms of Starfleet.
Well, I'm very confident that if anyone knows that policy back to forward, it is William Riker.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of like a pre-Monica Lewinsky world, so maybe that wasn't like as top of mind, where a senior officer could be dating one of the junior officers and have it be sort of a controversial thing, at least in the writing of the show, a more innocent time.
Right, definitely. Again, we are talking about 1991 here.
So we check out in the shuttle bay. Crusher is talking with Geordi about a very important operation going on the ship. She's planning some sort of musical theater production on the Enterprise. A lot of musical theater goes on the Enterprise D.
Right. Well, they, you know, it's like peacetime. You know, there are individual conflicts with aliens, but by and large, once you get to the Next Generation, it's a peaceful universe out there. And so there's a lot of time for like violin lessons and poetry writing and definitely a lot of plays. I think it's funny that Crusher wants Geordi to be in The Pirates of Penzance. That's what the song is that they're singing there. Mm-hmm. You think that's like a dig at the fact that like he's missing his eyes. Like maybe he's kind of piratey. Like he wouldn't need an eye patch.
Wow. So that in the prop department, in the costuming, they would have a real challenge for Geordi as a pirate.
Yeah, exactly. He would have to take off his visor and then I guess they'd need like two eye patches.
Meanwhile, on the bridge, Deanna Troi is introducing the winners of a science project to Picard. You know, they don't really ever explore the family element of the Enterprise D too much in the episodes. You know, it's sort of introduced early on. The Enterprise D has about 1,000 people and you're allowed to have like your families, even though every single week the Enterprise is in like an incredibly dangerous, life-threatening situation. Nobody really ever questions whether or not there should be, you know, taking your kids out on the ship with them. And I guess that I don't know how many kids are in the school, but I can't imagine there's more than what, you know, 15 kids on the Enterprise.
Well, no, I think that I remember at some point, it might even be in the pilot episode for the series, they say that there's going to be like 900 something people on the Enterprise. And I'm sure a lot of them are eligible bachelors like William Riker, but there definitely are families on the ship. And that's another thing I like about this episode is, like you said, a lot of the episodes don't touch on this fact, but it's not just our main crew. We have this ship is full of people. It's got almost 1,000 people living on it. And this is an episode that shows like, yeah, there are families, there are children, there are science fairs. Like for a lot of people, this is their day to day life. And it's interesting that you're right. They go into a lot of dangerous situations, but clearly Starfleet doesn't plan on there being that much danger out in space if they're willing to send all of these preschoolers out in there.
Right. Like how many kids are in the elementary school on the Enterprise D?
I have no idea. I'm sure that it's probably written down in a book somewhere. I would say probably my bet would be more than 15, like you said, but it can't be too many.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm not super impressed with the science fair winners. I know that they won a tour of the ship and they get to hang out with Picard, but I don't know what the competition was for the Enterprise D elementary school science fair.
And if we look at the ones who did win, like what their science projects were, I mean, if this is the best that the Enterprise D right. elementary school has to offer, like what were the other kids working on?
Because when we find out what the kids actually worked on, it's not super impressive that we have the youngest kid. He says we planted radishes in some weird dirt.
Right. And then they grew up all weird.
They grew weird. Yeah. And then we don't even find out what the young girl did in her science project that they like the Enterprise gets disabled by the time before she can even spit out what she did.
Right. She's very nervous around the captain, which is it's an interesting thing that he makes her number one.
Yes, but she is the tallest.
Right. And I think that in an emergency situation, that's what you definitely have to revert to.
And so we're going to see Picard go off with the kids and O'Brien is like joking around like, boy, I don't know if I feel worse for the kids or for Picard, because Picard does have a weird relationship with children. He doesn't have kids of his own and he's kind of cranky. He doesn't really like kids, but then, you know, he does seem like to, you know, he has like a weird fatherly relationship with Wesley Crusher.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I love so much about Captain Picard. I mean, you can look at all of the other captains, but Captain Picard is the only one who's like on the record with hating children. And I think that's just something that I have in common with him. So, I think that's really great. And then again, he's still good with children. He learns over the course of this episode sort of how to get them to do what they need to do. So it's not about him not knowing how to operate around children so much as that he just doesn't like them very much and he doesn't like being around them.
One thing that does bother me, though, as we get into the fifth season of TNG, I never liked Picard's tunic that's like a sweater.
That's funny that you mentioned that. I watched this with my girlfriend last night. We watched it together and that was the one of the only comments that she made during the episode. She was like, I like that sweater. That's a good sweater.
No, I don't like it. I don't like it. Now, is this only a Picard thing that you don't see other characters wearing this? Is this a captain's choice?
I think that in the universe, in the story, it's sort of just like, well, the captain, he gets a little bit more of an expansive wardrobe. We see with Captain Kirk that he has like a green sort of a tunic that he wears sometimes that the other crew members don't get. I think in real life, it's that Patrick Stewart really didn't like the uniforms. They had a tendency to ride up. There's like in the fandom, people talk about the Picard maneuver, which is that he's always pulling down because it rides up. And so I think that by the time season five rolls around, you know, Patrick Stewart's like, listen, I'm the star of the show. I'm going to wear a sweater. I don't need to wear this tight, you know, thing anymore.
All right, so this is the point at which the Enterprise ends up hitting the quantum filament. A whole lot of shaking going on. Chess pieces are falling off the board. The Enterprise will suffer some major casualties here, but we never quite get a body count of what happened.
Well, at one point, everyone on the bridge thinks that everyone's dead. The Ensign Rowe especially is like, I think we're the only survivors in this entire ship.
Yeah,
but yeah, in terms of like on-screen body count, the only person that I think we see actually die is the person who is piloting the ship, and I don't even know that we get a name for her.
No, I think Lieutenant Monroe is her name, and I talked about this in last week's episode, and this will be a recurring theme in our discussion of Star Trek. A lot of exploding consoles. That seems to be the number one cause of death on these Federation starships is exploding consoles when there's any sort of impact.
Yeah, I don't know if insurance companies still exist in the 24th century, but I feel like there's probably a pretty good lawsuit waiting that's like, if we look at every single episode of Star Trek, probably one of the most common causes of death isn't like aliens throwing rocks at you. It's the consoles exploding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Faulty manufacture.
And that's what's going to happen to Lieutenant Monroe. And so they're going to be shorthanded on the bridge. Basically, this is a weird episode that I mentioned 1,000 crew members on the Enterprise. We seem to be shorthanded in a lot of places, specifically that it's going to be a big plot point in the episode that there's nobody down in engineering. Did everybody die in engineering, John? Why is nobody down? I know Geordi is in the shuttle bay, but why is there no crew member in engineering at this point in this disaster?
Well, I really don't have a great answer for you. I think that they're kind of just in silent running. Like, I don't think that they're on their way to anywhere. It seems
it's
like a really quiet day.
It's not the middle of the night.
But it does seem like a quiet day. Like, I don't know if you've ever been on a cruise, but sometimes there's just days where, like, you're just kind of floating at sea and you aren't on your way to or from anywhere. And maybe, you know, maybe a lot of the engineering crew is hanging out in 10 forward. Maybe they're in their bunks. But yeah, we do know that. Or maybe there was just mass casualties in there and like they didn't want to show that on the show because ultimately, you know, I guess we're going to leap ahead here. But like the person who fixes the problem in engineering ends up being Riker and Data. So we don't even see by the end of the episode anyone in engineering.
And they don't treat it at the end of the episode where Picard isn't like, Captain's log, we suffered massive casualties. You know, I mean, they're joking around at the end of the episode and bringing the kids from the science fair back to the bridge. It's not treated as though 50 crew members died in this incident.
Right. Like, even if no one else died, we know on screen that, like, some poor woman gets her face melted off by an exploding console.
Never forget.
And then we get to the end of the episode and it's just like everyone's elbowing each other and like, who's the captain? Who's number one? Ha ha, chuckle. And it's like, there's a dead woman. Don't forget Monroe.
Right. Right. I mean, that there's one point at 10 forward where it looks like dead bodies are being brought in and Worf is like, put him over there.
Just put him in the corner. Well, that's a very Worf thing to do, though.
Stack the corpses. Babies over here. Corpses over there.
Right. Yeah. If you're ever in a disaster situation, you need to establish there's the pee corner. There's the bodies corner and then the babies corner. I think you need three corners to survive any disaster situation.
Yeah. And no pun intended for the late, great Lieutenant Monroe, but a real skeleton crew on the bridge during this episode where we end up having Jess, Deanna Troi, Jess Chief O'Brien, and then we're going to see Ensign Roe come out of the turbo lift, and then there's just like one other guy.
He doesn't even get, I think he has one or two lines at the beginning of the episode, and then nothing. He does not get to participate in any of those boardroom meetings, which is funny because the whole plot point on the bridge is that Deanna Troi becomes the ranking officer, which I think is it's a great episode for her. But like everyone is put into a position where they have more power than they're used to or more responsibility. But then it's like that guy, he's still a nobody.
Yeah, and but even if he's a nobody, he's still the same rank as Ensign Roe.
Right, but he just wasn't getting paid as much as Michelle Forbes.
He's not as ballsy as she is. She was very much wanting to get her opinions across. So, all right, so Picard is in the elevator with the kids. They're all hysterical. These kids, much like Ensign Roe, are a bunch of negative Nancys, very convinced that they're all going to die.
Oh my God. Well, there's the one we didn't talk about, the kid whose science experiment is like he watched these flies and they only live for 20 hours and then they just die.
They're very morbid kids.
Well, especially this one kid who that like his fly science experiment, he only talks about how they're all going to die. Like there's this sort of underlying very dark humor joke that like this kid is very upset by his fly experiment because every time he has a line, it's just like, this turbo lift is going to crash and we're all going to die. Or like the captain's going to die because his ankle is broken. Well, maybe that's just if you're on the Enterprise and you're in preschool and you're facing down.
Yeah.
You know, if you're facing down the Borg every other week, like maybe you're just life is cheap when you're a preschooler on the Enterprise D.
Which is maybe speaks to the point of we should be rethinking the number of children that are on board the Enterprise D, considering the number of life threatening situations the crew faces every single episode of the show. So. So I guess that might have just been sort of ingrained in growing up on the Enterprise.
Yeah, well, we see when Deep Space Nine starts, Keiko O'Brien, featured in this episode, she starts a school on the Deep Space Nine space station. And like there is an actual war that happens on that series. Like that becomes the battle line. That is like where the front lines of a war. And there's a preschool there.
I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, you want these people and people are going to have families. And so you're away in space. So I guess like what are the options? Sort of like do you leave your kid back on a planet or do you bring your kids with you?
It's a tough decision, and it's one that I don't plan on having to ever make.
We are able to get some sensors back online thanks to Ensign Roe. She is able to bring some sensors up, and we have some very specific information that really the sensors are not really working, but we can sense that the warp core has a problem. That's one thing we're going to be able to sense. But whether or not anybody else is alive on the ship, that we don't know. Now, I feel like it would be very improbable that the bridge would be unaffected, but everybody else on the ship would be dead. Maybe they could consider there's some sort of a hull breach, but it seems unlikely that the bridge would be relatively unaffected and everybody else on the ship is dead.
I think that Ensign Roe is just sort of, like you said, she's sort of a negative Nancy. But I do think also the bridge is supposed to be moderately affected. Again, the only on-screen death we see happens on the bridge. And then, like, the lighting is very dark and brooding in the bridge for the rest of the episode. So at least a few light bulbs, like, went out.
Again, we see Deanna Troi really put into this position that she doesn't know what to do. O'Brien says, we need to go to emergency procedure Alpha 2. Ensign Roe knows exactly what that is. Deanna Troi is just like, yeah, I guess so. Now, Deanna Troi will then, after this episode, become more of, like, a regular officer. And we'll see her have command of the bridge later on. Ironically, she's going to be at the helm of the Enterprise when it goes down in Star Trek Generations, which is something that has always stuck in my craw, John.
Yeah, well, in the movies, the actual Hollywood movies, they do tend to like to blow up the Enterprise. That's a thing that they like to do. And yeah, Deanna Troi is one of the people who blows up the Enterprise. But I think this is a great episode for her because we see throughout the entire series that she is someone who kind of second guesses herself. And even though she has a good read on people, she's like an empath. She's not used to being in like a leadership position. And over the course of the series, we see this development where she's taking an interest in like officer training. And she really gets put to the test here because she has no self-confidence, but she is thrust into this position of power. And then she also has Ensign Roe just undermining her at every turn. It clearly Ensign Roe wants to be the next captain or whatever. And, you know, Deanna Troi ends up pulling it out.
It's an interesting gender dynamic of that Ensign Ro and Deanna Troi are getting into as the two women here. I mean, Chief O'Brien is not really challenging her power in any way. He respects the rank, but it is odd to see two women really butting heads here.
Right. Well, I think that, like I said, I think Ensign Ro wants more power. I think she sees this as her opportunity to sort of save the day. And Chief O'Brien, he's a consummate professional. He starts out life in Star Trek as the transporter room operator. Mm-hmm. And he's always just like, he's always pushing that button. There's a great webcomic, which is about Chief O'Brien, and he's operating the transporter room. And like, he's just a professional guy. And he's not going to question any loyalty.
And even with Keiko very much, you know, hanging in the balance, that he's able to very much focus on what's going on. But I guess because she's in the saucer section, he's not as worried about her that if the warp core goes, everybody's gone.
Right. Which is why that's the big point of conflict from the bridge is like, should we separate? If we separate, then everyone might die. That's not in the saucer. But maybe they're already dead anyway, and we can save some of these people. And it's a pretty good sort of moral quandary for the episode.
Yeah, they really do tease the saucer separation quite a bit in this episode. The kids even want to go see the battle bridge on the tour. I feel like that the writers were trolling us of potential saucer separation action.
Yeah, well, that's so in the pilot episode, if you haven't watched the pilot episode recently, they do the saucer separation. And, you know, that's the first episode of the series. So, like, the writers set up, like, look at this new Enterprise. It can do all kinds of crazy stuff. We have a separate bridge for when we have battles, and we can send all the families away in the saucer. But I think over the course of the entire series, it only separates, like, maybe one or two more times. They don't ever really do it again. So there's a lot of teasing. And it just never really happens.
You know, that's a good point which ties back into this bigger discussion of the dangers of the family, that in the original conception, they had the idea of, OK, well, the Enterprise is going to be dealing with a lot of dangerous things. So when there's really dangerous stuff, they can separate the saucer and then just have the battle section of the Enterprise go off. But it turns out that was actually really expensive to do on the show. So the writers were sort of boxed in where they talked about it a lot, but then really were never able to pull it off too many other times. I believe they do it when they fight the Borg. There's like maybe one other time, I think, when they actually do it.
Possibly in one of the movies. Now, I'm not much of a television
maker.
Yeah,
well, they do it in the movie, yeah.
I feel like if you film it one time for the pilot, can't you just kind of reuse that same footage? Like, it's just a couple shots of it separating, but what do I know?
Yeah, I guess they didn't want it to be sort of like Tecmo Bowl, where you have only like one animation of the guy scoring the touchdown, and it's the same thing every single time. So I don't know. I don't know the exact details of how expensive it was to separate the saucer from the drive section of the Enterprise in 1990, but apparently it was cost prohibitive. Going back to Riker in 10 Forward, him and Data are talking about what's going on, and they feel like they need to get down to engineering to check everything out. Riker says, we need to prepare for the worst, that everybody is dead.
Yeah, and that's something that happens a lot in the episode. Everyone else thinks like they're kind of the only survivors on the ship.
It's all on me.
It's all on me. And I think that is harkening back to how this is an homage to disaster movies, where you have these like really big death tolls. But at the end of the day, it is a syndicated, you know, PBS television series. And we know that everyone can't be dead, but they handle it pretty well. Like, you know, like Riker is really good friends with a lot of these people. Like we were talking earlier, he may have had multiple relationships with lots of people. And he's just like, well, they're all dead. We got to go to work.
Yeah, we need to go figure out what's going on. So they're going to head in the Jefferies tube, and we're going to see this. They're going to end up being trapped in this. But it seems like that this is a really long way to go in the Jefferies tube for me. In terms of like where they are on the ship, they could not be further away from engineering in 10 Forward, as I understand the layout of the Enterprise. It seems like that they would be going a great distance crawling through the tubes.
Yeah, I, you know, I have not studied the blueprints of the Enterprise recently, so I'm going to defer to you on that one.
Well, 10 forward is certainly the most, is really like the nose of the ship, and then the warp core, as I understand it, is in the neck of the ship, which is connected to the saucer section, and so. You got to go across the whole saucer in the tubes.
Yeah, your knees are going to be really sore.
I mean, it's no issue for Data, but for Riker. And they always have to go side by side in the tubes.
Yeah, well, I think that from a filming standpoint, it's kind of like the walk and talk, but it's like the crawl and discuss. Yeah. Like, you have to have both people on screen.
So we also set up for Dr. Crusher and Geordi that Dr. Crusher notices, Geordi, this wall is hot. I'm not sure why Geordi's visor, which I know can pick up temperature of the room, he's not on top of that first, that raging plasma fire that's behind the wall. But it's actually Dr. Crusher that notices. There's some heat coming from this wall. That's not good.
I believe, and I could be wrong, but I think that Geordi's visor has a few different options where he has like heat sensor, or he has like X-ray vision, or like he has a couple different
in that setting.
Yeah. So maybe he just didn't have the heat sensor turned on.
Yeah. All right. Well, plasma fire is going up, and big problem. They happen to have these barrels in this shuttle bay, which are very sensitive to radioactivity. And this plasma fire is really generating a lot of radioactivity. And these plasma barrels, or this plasma fire, could explode these barrels. And of course, that could also take out the ship.
Right. Well, it's kind of interesting. In the future, we have, there seems to be no more poverty. There's no more hunger. There really isn't any war, at least on the planet Earth. Like, it seems like a much better, happier, safer society. But also in the future, like, you're just going to carry on your ship just these barrels full of nuclear explosives, just probably directly underneath the preschool. And it's like, it's a little give and take there. Like, nuclear devices are pretty easy to come by in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also felt like that the barrels had all been stacked in a way that they just seemed like they were asking to be knocked over.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There's no one cares about them. It's like, oh, this isn't a big problem until suddenly it is when you have this plasma fire going on.
It's just the shuttle bay.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many other plasma fires do you think broke out in the ship? Was that just incredibly unlucky that one plasma fire broke out in that one spot on the ship?
Well, I think we're just lucky that like one didn't break out in 10 forward, because then, Worf would have to really juggle giving birth to a baby and then putting out fires. So, yeah, maybe it was just in the one area.
And this quantum filament really did knock out like very specific systems on the Enterprise, that life support, gravity, all unaffected. The lights don't really go out too badly in any place on the ship. But I guess things like the fire prevention system on the Enterprise is something that was greatly affected by the quantum filament.
Right. And there's only serious damage in rooms where the main characters are. Like, how did the quantum filament know about
that?
We
don't know that. There could have been some sort of like major disaster right next door to engineering, which ended up taking out everybody that was working in engineering.
Right. I guess that's a good point.
Yeah, we don't know. We just said that nobody else was important enough for us to see what was going on. Meanwhile, we end up going back to the bridge, and Ensign Ro, she is able to see what's going on with the warp core, and she realizes that there has been a polarity shift, and we are in danger of containment breach of the warp core. And this is where she really starts beating this drum that we need to separate the saucer. What she ends up doing is she takes the power from the phasers and pumps it into the engineering console on the bridge. John, to me, that seems like overkill.
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird that that's the same type of like power or energy. Like, what you can power your weapons with also can power that other section of the ship. But again, Ensign Ro is just going to do what she wants. I can't help but wonder if she didn't get like kind of punished after this. She makes a couple bad calls and she goes completely over the head of acting captain. Yeah.
Yeah. So we see where Riker and Data are also, they're on their way over to engineering, and there's sort of like, I don't know, a fire or something. There's like some sort of like a coolant leak, which sounds very dangerous, that for at least for Riker to be inhaling that coolant leak. So they end up closing one of the portals in the Jefferies tube behind them. But then there's sort of like this field of electricity also going back and forth. They don't know what to do. Data says maybe his body could absorb the electricity.
Yeah, he says that his body is made out of like non-reflective materials. And so if he walks in polymers, yeah. So if he walks in front of the electricity, like his body will start to melt, but then it'll actually stop the electricity from damaging Riker.
And the other part of this plan was they could then take off Data's head, and then they could use that ongoing in engineering. And so that was going to be the plan. Now, I thought it would have been a better idea to take Data's head off first.
Yeah. Well, maybe can he walk around without his head connected?
You would think so. You would think
the rules about the whole like removing the head thing are kind of weird, because the Data, if you're not super, super familiar with TNG specifically, he's an android. So he's like somewhere halfway between, you know, a human and a robot. But they established pretty clearly in season 2's Measure of a Man that he is a sentient being, that he's considered alive. And so like if he's part man or half alive or whatever, like it's weird that they can just remove his head completely with no real problems. But it happens a couple times. I think later in the series, he loses his head too.
Yeah. And it brings up an interesting question about Data, where is Data's battery? Data is obviously, you know, he runs on some sort of power. And if he does not get charged, or I think he can eat food also. I'm not sure if he can sort of like get power from eating food, but I know that he can ingest things. So, but like, where is Data's battery pack? And it must be somewhere in his head, unless he has like multiple like places where he's able to store his power, because the head is able to operate independently of the body. You would think that the battery would be in the body section, but the body does not seem to be able to move independently when it is not attached to the head. You would think that he would have like some sort of Bluetooth where he'd be able to control the body when his head's not connected.
Right. Well, maybe it's like solar charging or something. Like if he's just standing in certain rooms or certain light, he can recharge.
It brings up a good question about Data as well, because Data does not seem to have any sort of Wi-Fi, Bluetooth functionality. Data needs to be connected to the ship, but Data is not able to be like on the ship's network without, you know, typing things in or asking questions. Well, why can't Data connect to the ship's computer?
Well, maybe that's one of the areas of the ship that got damaged. Like I was recently...
No, in general.
Well, I mean, I think if we want to give the real life answer, it's because those things hadn't been invented or even conceived of yet in sort
of
real life.
Well, I don't care about real life answers. I want to know the 24th century.
I don't know. I think that in this situation, any Wi-Fi network maybe got knocked out. And so, you know, he wasn't able to connect to it. So he has to be manually plugged in. No. It's lucky that he's able to plug in. You know, they're in a random crawl space halfway between engineering and 10 forward. And it's like, oh, this conduit, this is the right one for me. Like I can access everything from here.
Yeah, I'll prefer to say the answer is in the 24th century. Data, in an effort to be more human, chooses not to use his Wi-Fi connectivity or Bluetooth connectivity and wants to do things like humans and other, you know, sentient beings do it.
Because it's very human to plug your uncovered brain into the machine of
his
ship.
This is an emergency. But okay, so like when he's in his room aside and he's asking the computer to like turn on the lights, like he could obviously, you know, just do it himself remotely, but he wants to, you know, do things like people do them.
Well, you're right. He chooses time and time again to be human when he doesn't need to be. Like we see him trying to learn about poetry and he doesn't need to eat, but you're right. He does eat. He enjoys those things. And like he's always trying to learn how to be more human. So I think your answer probably makes the most sense.
So we end up with Picard in the elevator. Picard has suffered some sort of an injury. It's really unclear what happened to Picard. He like sprained his ankles falling down.
Yeah, he says it's broken, but you know, maybe it's just sprained.
Yeah. I mean, Picard Picard comes off as a little frail in this episode. I mean, there's other episodes. Actually, the one that I had gotten this confused with to some degree is next season Starship Mine, which is the episode that's sort of like the Die Hard episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. I mean, Picard is, you know, a real tough guy there. But yeah, he's very like frail and, you know, needs a number of children to help him here.
Yeah, it's not the best look for him that he needs like three, you know, 6 year olds to help him move around. And basically, you know, that lift ends up falling. Like he would be dead if it weren't for these children. Maybe it's a really bad break. Maybe like when the turbo lift kind of crashed, like one of the kids fell onto him or something. So maybe like someone fell onto his ankle.
One of the things that does bother me about the turbo lift is that the way that the turbo lifts are set up in the Enterprise is that they can go, you know, north and south, but also east and west. This was a very unlucky break for Picard and the kids that they happened to be in one of the areas of the ship where there was like the steepest vertical drop.
Right. Yeah. There's no like east and west junctions that you can see when they're climbing on there. And it is quite a long and then, you know, you say that Picard's kind of a weakling in this episode, but he ends up climbing a ladder for like 3 hours on a broken ankle. So, you know, that's pretty tough, I think.
So Picard orders the kids that he's like, he's the one kid and he's like looking at like the side of the elevator and they realize that, oh no, this is actually not connected. So Picard orders the kids to leave him for dead. They will not. They all go. So he orders them to open up this port and pull out all the optical cabling. John, why does the turbo lift have like 150 feet of spare cable just sticking out of it?
Well, I think there's a lot of redundancies built up into the Enterprise, right? So like it's, I mean, honestly, it's probably for just such a situation. Like it's not there to be used as a rope, but I think you have backup systems and generators put in place all over the place so that if one thing fails, you have extra, you know, cabling and stuff.
What? That there's so much cable. They tied it around everybody's waist multiple times.
Right. And again, like you're talking about how come there's no Wi-Fi? Like how come there needs to be that much cabling for some lights? You'd think that it would be like LED lights or something, but I don't know. Again, man, it's 1991. What do you want?
Meanwhile, we see Worf back in 10 Forward, and he's sort of leading this group of, what would you call this, what's being set up? This, like, MASH unit.
Yeah, it's like triage. Like, they're figuring out who needs help and who doesn't, and who actually is injured, and who can help with the injuries. This is my favorite part of the whole episode. I love Worf in any situation, but like he's the one, like now he has to be a medical officer and he has to have bedside manner, and like he's definitely the biggest fish out of water out of all of these different subplots.
Yes, this is the best stuff in the entire episode, because now Keiko O'Brien is going into labor a month early and Worf is the only person around who can deliver this baby.
Right, because he took the Starfleet like pregnancy simulator course.
Yes. So meanwhile, back on the bridge, Ensign Ro is getting even more adamant about doing the saucer separation. And she's saying that they need to do this now because otherwise the whole ship is going to go up. And what they ultimately end up deciding is to divert power to engineering so that they could see what's going on. If there is anybody alive in engineering, once they divert power to the monitors there, then they'll be able to see that there's a problem.
Right, which is a big gambit because Ensign Ro is still there beating that same drum. Like, everyone's dead. We're just wasting time. If we're diverting power away, we won't have enough power to do the saucer separation. And there's like a ticking time bomb of how much, what percentage is left of this power. And if it gets below 15, like it's too late and they're all going to die. And so that's the first moment where Deanna actually makes a decision that goes against what sort of her crew is telling her, because she's leading with her heart, which, you know, at the end of the episode, we learn is that's the way to be a good leader is to trust your heart.
Well, I don't want to be results oriented here, but who do you think had the right call? Was it Troy to sort of, okay, let's see how this plays out, or Ensign Ro of doing what is in the best interest of the people in the saucer section?
Well, I'm not the kind of like when I am in leadership positions, I like to take all of the information that I have and sort of delay any major decision making until the last possible moment. Right. So I think that I would definitely think that the right call is to wait until that 15% or just before it. Like they know, you know, O'Brien says they have until it's at 15% and it's not going to be too much of a problem until that moment. And so really just to kind of wait, I think that
but then it could blow.
Yeah, but it's going to be safe up until that point. So I think that if you give people, if there are people alive, there's such a limited amount of information that they have. If you wait until the last possible moment to give other survivors, if they are out there, the most chance that they possibly can have, I think that's probably the best decision, because if they don't do anything at all, then people are definitely going to die. And if they separate the saucer, then pretty much everyone's going to die that's not in the saucer. And so, you know, I think that sort of that middle road ends up being the best one, results oriented or otherwise.
See, I got the sense that if it got down to 15%, the ship was going to blow. Like, it wasn't like, okay, now at 15%, let's do the saucer separation and then let's get out of here before it gets to zero. I
felt maybe like, 16 then. Like, let's cut the cord at 16.
Well, I just don't know. How far away do you have to be from the warp core if that blows to have everybody be safe? I mean, it's not necessarily like you are signing the death warrant of everybody that is going to be in the drive section of the ship. Like, there's still a chance they could figure it out on their own, but at some point I think you have to be responsible for all of the, you know, the aforementioned families and children on this ship and get them the hell out of there. I'm Team Ensign Ro on this. I don't agree with her tactics, but I do think she had the right idea, and Deanna Troi really did get lucky that Riker and Data just happened to get down there in time,
right? Because again, the engineering, we never see what's going on in there, but no one in engineering actually sees it. It's Riker and Data who end up saving the day with that plot line.
Yeah, I mean, she really did catch a lucky break there. I don't think that Ensign Ro should beat herself up too much about this. But anyway, we see the kids and they're now, you know, having to climb up from floor to floor. They can't get any of the doors open. They need a climbing song, Picard asks. So he asks the girl if she knows any good climbing songs. She talks about the laughing Vulcan and his dog, and even Picard is like, I've never heard of that.
Right. There's a nice little moment. It's another one of those things where it's like Picard doesn't get kids. It's like this. It's like Generation X versus Millennials. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know, these new kids, they have these terrible songs. When I grew up, we were still singing Farajaka.
Right. Now, is the laughing Vulcan and his dog, is this like a new piece of music that the young people are listening to? That it's just that these kids and their music? Or is this a standard that has just missed Picard?
I think that it's probably, like, if Picard heard it, it would just be beeps and whistles to him. Just like these kids today, they don't understand true classic music.
Yes. So we end up with a rousing rendition of Frère Jacques, and Picard is really into it. He loves it.
It says, well, he's so French. That's the thing, is they love to reiterate over the course of the series, like, Jean-Luc Picard is a French man. He might be played by a British man, but he's so French. And they really like to reiterate it. If I have to pick a single weak point of this episode or something that's not my favorite, it's that I think this goes on a little too long. They get through like three or four verses of Frère Jacques.
Yeah, it does. But I do feel like that it's probably the maybe second most iconic or memorable thing from this episode behind Worf delivering the baby. I do think that this is pretty lasting, the Frère Jacques.
Yeah, sure. And it is a nice moment. I think it goes on a little overly long, but you're right. I think this is probably the second best like plot line. I like how Picard kind of wins the kids over and he gets them to sort of be brave. And it's like I said at the beginning of this podcast, this episode puts characters in situations they are not used to being in or comfortable in, but it reiterates their true core character. So we see Captain Picard in a position not of power, and he's injured and he's surrounded by kids who he doesn't want to be around and doesn't like. But through this situation, we see that he's a good leader and a natural captain. And it reifies that entire idea that he is one of the best captains in Starfleet.
We go back to Worf and Keiko, and Worf is able to get a tricorder reading that Keiko is now 7 centimeters along. He tells her that did not take very long, and she gives him a really priceless look. And she wants to know if the baby turned, that there was some concern the baby had not turned over. Worf doesn't really seem up to the task to be able to, like, investigate that matter.
It's interesting. He says that none of that came up in his training simulator. But, you know, I'm not a doctor and I've never given birth. But, like, just by being a human and being around humans, I know a little bit about how it works. And, like, the idea of a baby, you know, being breech or whatever, like, I understand what that is. And Worf has no idea. It makes me wonder a little bit about how Klingons give birth.
I suspect we may just have, you know, the Klingon female just sort of, like, goes off into the woods and, like, does her own thing and then just comes out victoriously with the baby.
Right, like holding it over her head like a championship, you know, cup or something. Yeah.
Yes, that's the honorable way that the Klingon female gives birth. So back in the shuttle bay, we come up with this plan of, all right, well, what if we depressurize the shuttle bay? All we would need to do is just hold on to this ladder, and then we'll just open up the shuttle bay door, and then we will need to then repressurize the shuttle bay. What do you think of this plan? What could go wrong?
Now, right. So we were talking about being results oriented with Ensign Roe and Deanna Troi, but this is a terrible idea. And it's really, really fortunate that it works out, because they're like, let's just expose our, you know, unprotected bodies to the horrors of the vacuum of space. And, like, there's going to be barrels full of nuclear bombs, and there's going to be radioactive plasma fires, like, flying out the window near our bodies. Like, as long as we can hold our breath for a good minute, like, everything will be fine.
Yeah, John, I'm not a scientist, but from what I understand, I don't know how well the human body will hold up against the vacuum of space.
Very, very poorly. One of the interesting things that happens because of the difference in pressure, there's no air pressure in space, is that the boiling point of liquids is very, very different in outer space. And so your blood will actually boil at room temperature. So, like, that's one of the things that would kill you first if the lack of oxygen or the sub-zero temperatures didn't kill you. Like, you basically die 8 different ways simultaneously if you're exposed to the vacuum of space. None of which comes up in this episode. They just hold their breath for a while and they get a little bit dizzy.
Yeah. They also are like, oh, well, we need to hold on to something. And, like, what about this ladder? And the ladder does not appear to be that solid. Like, it's kind of shaking as, like, Dr. Crusher is, like, moving it back and forth. She's like, this will work.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, that ladder is obviously a prop. And I'm sure that, you know, they were told, like, all right, you're going to walk up to this prop and, like, you're going to say that it's really steady and stable.
But it's
and then,
not.
Yeah, I think that LeVar Burton kind of got a little overexcited and he gave it a good shake. And it's like, oh, this is just plywood.
It's too strong. And so they're ultimately going to open up the shuttle bay door, which is going to suck the oxygen out of the room and put out the plasma fire and suck the barrels also out the shuttle bay door. But this is a very risky plan, because while Geordi is able to open the shuttle bay door from the console next to the ladder, then also somebody has to run over to the panel, which is by the door, to repressurize the shuttle bay.
Yeah, this is very bad design on the part of whomever designed the Enterprise, that you're having the repressurization button being on a different console on the opposite side of the room of the airlock button. I don't even know why. Like, why isn't it automatically repressurizing? You think that that's something that would automatically happen once the door closes again?
I'll give them the benefit of the doubt that maybe this is just one of those systems that automatically it would do that, but that the automatic controls are down.
Okay.
So they have to go, and Dr. Crusher ends up being the person that she, like, runs over there. Geordi passes out like a chump, and then
yeah,
Dr.
She really
Crusher
crushes it.
Yes, she does. But she, like, barely, like, just gets a hand on, like, thank God she hit the right button.
Yeah, there's all kinds of buttons on that thing, and she just kind of slaps it, and it just happens that she hits the right one.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in the ready room, we are getting some more heated debate between Troi and Ensign Roe and Chief O'Brien, and she's really riding Troi. She says, you can't let wishful thinking guide you in this situation. But then Deanna Troi really puts Ensign Roe in her place, where she says what she wants to do. She says, is that clear, Ensign?
And I always love, it's something I've always loved in Star Trek and in like Battlestar Galactica. I love that sir is the term for any ranking officer, regardless of their gender or sex. Mm-hmm. Like Chief O'Brien calls Deanna sir throughout the whole episode. That's something that I've always thought was really interesting. That happens in real life too, apparently, like in the Navy.
And I like when the characters use like a lower character's rank as an insult.
Right. Yeah. It's like reminding you of your place. It's a really short way to knock someone down a peg.
Yeah.
And, not a Simon Pegg.
No. That you would love it if they got knocked a Simon Pegg.
Right.
So Picard and the kids ultimately get out of the turbo lift. They make it. They get to safety, thankfully. And Picard did save the kids from the falling turbo lift. So that's one good thing that happened.
There's a moment where Picard gets out of the turbo lift and he's just kind of laying there. And then the other kids use his ankle as like a thing that they pull themselves up out of the turbo lift. And it's like, isn't that his broken ankle?
Mm-hmm.
It's not very considerate of these little kids.
Meanwhile, in 10 Forward, speaking of 10 Forward, Keiko O'Brien has now dilated to 10 centimeters. And
congratulations.
Worf gives her the permission. He says, you are at 10 centimeters. You may now give birth.
It's one of my favorite Worf lines. That and, like, I am not a merry man are two of my favorite Worf quotes. It's great.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, he has a bunch of great lines here that he tells Keiko, the computer simulation was not like this.
Right. And there's actually, so here's a little fun thing is that in Deep Space Nine, season 4 or 5, Worf ends up transferring to the Deep Space Nine. So he and Keiko are reintroduced and Keiko ends up, spoiler alert, getting pregnant again with a second child. And there's an episode where there's this throwaway line about how Keiko is entering into her third trimester. And then Worf is like, I'm going to take some time off. And like he just disappears for like 4 episodes. He goes on vacation. He doesn't want to be anywhere near Keiko and her second child being born.
Yeah, Worf is really terrible. I mean, this did not seem like it was a difficult birth in any way.
No, and even she was worried that it was going to be upside down, that Molly, the baby, was going to be upside down. And that even that doesn't end up happening. He really barely does anything other than just kind of giving her commands.
Yes. So that he asks her if she has the uncontrollable urge to push yet at this point. Finally, the baby comes and Worf announces that I will now smack the child to induce breathing. I don't think you need to do this, right?
You actually have children, so maybe you know a little more than I do, but I think that I don't know that they smack them, but I do know that you need to make them start breathing and crying a little bit, because sometimes babies come out and they have like a blockage in their nose or in their throat. So you need to kind of make sure that they're going to be breathing heavily.
I did not see that in my own Starfleet simulations that we ran. So Worf ends up with the baby and he holds the baby for an uncomfortably long amount of time before giving the baby to Keiko. I don't know how Keiko didn't say to him like, hey, all right, hand the baby over.
Right. She just did all of that hard work. Well, I'm sure that it's weird for Worf. Like, he's never seen a freshly born human baby before. Like, that's probably very strange as a Klingon to see, like, what that looks like.
Do you feel like that it was awkward for Worf and Keiko after this?
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I'd like to think that they're all professionals.
Or for Worf and Chief O'Brien after this.
That might have been a little bit awkward for a while. Like, thank you for delivering the baby. Like, how involved were you?
Mm-hmm. And they had to work together on Deep Space Nine then, even after that.
Right. You can imagine there's like a couple coffee breaks or Ractogino breaks where they're like, so how's the baby and Keiko and all that?
All right. So ultimately, that because of the work that Data was able to provide, Riker got him hooked up. There's a really funny moment also where Riker is like connecting the wires to Data's head and he ends up like plugging the wire into the wrong thing and like Data's like eyes cross and he's like, that is not the right port.
Yeah, it's weird. How can he even see what he's doing? Like, he's standing face to face with Data's head, which, you know, lets you do the shot, reverse shot from a filmmaking perspective. But the cords and the wires are all in the back of his head. So it's no wonder that he made a mistake.
Yeah. But that ultimately ends up fixing the problem. And Ensign Ro, she ends up with a mea culpa to Troy. Says like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, I shouldn't have doubted you. You had it the whole time. But she really didn't.
No, and you're probably right that Ensign Ro made the right call. I think this is a good lesson, is that, you know, it's not about necessarily what you say, it's how you say it. Maybe if she'd been a little less confrontational to Troy, who was obviously going through her own sort of stuff, maybe she would have been more apt to listen.
Mm-hmm. So we end up with sort of like our epilogue on the bridge, where we are headed over to Starbase 67 because we need to have some repairs done on the ship. I think it would have been nice if we would have had some sort of memorial service for the people that we lost to the quantum filament.
Yeah, they're all just standing around the exact spot where Lieutenant Monroe was murdered, and they don't even care.
Yeah. She died as she lived, Lieutenant Monroe.
Yeah, without lines or anyone noticing at all.
So the kids are back on the bridge, like, hey, what about that tour? What about that? Are we going to get that tour at all of the ship? We haven't seen enough of the inside of the turbo lift shaft, but we need to see everything now.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what areas are off limits if you aren't like an officer, because if they live on the ship and maybe they go to work with their parents one day, like, why, you'd think that the kids would have seen a good chunk of the ship at this point. But they apparently haven't, because Picard's going to show them all over the place.
Yeah, they're probably confined to the crew quarters. But like, what do they want to see that they have not seen? I mean, I feel like that the interior of the Enterprise pretty much all looks the same. I guess that the kids might want to see 10 forward. I don't know if they're allowed to go there. And then, I don't know what else there is to look at. Engineering.
Yeah, all the crawl spaces.
The brig. They could show them the brig.
Right. I'm just trying to think of like random one-off room sets that we've seen over the course of the series. Like,
yeah,
I don't know, the shuttle bay.
Yeah, they go see the shuttle bay. They don't even make stellar cartography until we get to the movies.
Right.
So I guess that they could show them like, I don't know, where like the photon torpedoes are and stuff like that. So who knows? Anyway, the kids have a plaque for Picard. And they present it to him. I'm sure Picard threw that right in the trash because we never see that again.
It looks really crummy, and it's not the best. And Picard is not very good at faking it. He's just like, oh, thank you very much. But like, he's not, it doesn't look great. It's like crayon on construction paper. And it's like, thank you for not letting us die. Sincerely, these three kids.
Do you think that Picard ever interacted with these kids ever again?
No, I'm sure he went out of his way to like avoid them. Like, he was taking different turbo lifts. They didn't even draw on it. Like, they could have drawn like little stick figures of like what Picard was going to look like. It's just writing on a piece of paper. There's very little thought that went into this gift.
Yeah. Ultimately, Picard ends up telling them that they'll go for a tour of the battle bridge, even which we never get to see, or we rarely get to see. And then he says, "You've got the bridge, number one." And then Riker and the girl both say, "I, Captain." And then, why did the girl think that she has the bridge? Like, that was very presumptuous of her.
Because she's arrogant. Maybe her silence isn't embarrassment, but that she thinks that she's better than everybody else.
Yeah, it really went to her head, her mission with Captain Picard. And that is disaster.
There it is. Another great episode in the can. So do you see what I'm talking about? Like, I think that the actual episode itself is kind of silly, but it really lays a lot of groundwork in terms of it. It introduces a lot of great character traits. It puts them in fun situations. We see character development, which is something that you don't see too much in shows prior to like the mid to late 90s. There's a little bit of serialization here, where there's this big payoff of Deanna Troi finally getting to be in the captain's chair. After this episode, she starts actually wearing Starfleet, you know, uniforms. Like, it kind of feels like
that she was allowed to wear her own sort of jumper, that was the only person on the ship that got to do her own thing.
And after this, she starts dressing differently. Like, it's I think that it's a portent of things to come. I think that without Star Trek The Next Generation and like the X-Files in the early 90s, like, you don't really get shows like Lost that start having like a lot more serialization. And then without that, you know, TV wouldn't look the way it does today.
Yeah. And so we were talking about, you know, they really do a great job of putting these characters in unfamiliar situations, having to deal with the kinds of things that they don't normally deal with. So great job. Glad they were able to fix Data's body so quickly after it melted. Glad that the radioactive issues with the barrels were able to be resolved. And really, we are able to, you know, patch things up really quickly. The quantum filament issue is never mentioned again.
Yeah, they just don't go to that part of space again. I think the one big payoff that doesn't happen in this episode is that they don't even mention the name of the baby. That's like one of the first lines in the episode is like, oh, what are we going to, are we going to name it Hero? Or are we going to name it Michael or whatever? Mm-hmm. And then it ends up being a girl, which they don't really even reference that fact. But yeah, they name it Molly, but they don't bring that up in this episode.
Perhaps the reason why the quantum filament disaster is never mentioned again, because shortly thereafter, an even worse disaster ends up striking the Enterprise as Wesley Crusher returns from Starfleet Academy with a very addictive app that he tries to get everybody to play.
Oh my God, that episode
I'm sorry, I have it wrong. That he's the only one who doesn't download the app and start to play this game.
That episode is another really interesting one that would be fun to talk about. That game is like, I don't know,
everybody
the 1991 graphics.
Yeah, but everybody puts on their Google Cardboard and is very much in the augmented reality world of basketball.
But it's that episode too, like it actually predicts like addictive apps. Like it kind of predicts Flappy Bird or like Candy Crush, not to be confused with Wesley Crusher. But yeah. You know what I mean? Like it seems silly at the time and the episode itself isn't that great. But that's another one where TNG was kind of ahead of the curve. Like they saw what
they
we were all going to turn into.
They saw it coming. All right. Well, John, thank you so much for going through all of this with me. You could follow John Krause on Twitter. He is at John Krause, that's JonKrause. John, is there anything else that people should check out?
I might have a couple things coming down the pipeline, but right now, I guess I would just recommend, I've been on the live feed updates every morning with Taryn pretty much, at least once a week this summer. And so that's been kind of fun.
Okay. So, be on the lookout for, more stuff from John Krause, and also be on the lookout for our recaps of Star Trek Discovery coming up here in just a couple of weeks. If you want to get your hands on the, coveted CBS All Access, you could use our link and go to postshowrecaps.com/all access for that. John, that's like right in your wheelhouse between Big Brother live feeds and Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, I will definitely be watching. My relationship with Star Trek Discovery has really had its ups and downs, but I think now that we are about 10 days away as of this recording, I'm starting to get really excited for it. I'm looking forward to seeing just new stories from the Star Trek universe.
All right. So more Trek Discovery stories coming as we get ready for Star Trek Discovery itself. You can subscribe to our Star Trek podcast here on Post Show Recaps. Go to postshowrecaps.com/Star Trek. Until next time, take care, everybody. Have a good time. Bye.